Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The events of the past year made us all realize that financial independence is one of the keys to surviving economic meltdown. How do you get there? Be frugal, be entrepreneurial, and light a Roman candle under your savings efforts. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by ConAgra Foods, the people behind brands like Marie Callender's, Hunt's, and Ready Whip. More at conagrafoods.com. And by Super Brands, Brandweek's annual ranking and analysis of America's top 2,000 brands. You can Google Brandweek Super Brands for more information.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the third day of July. Hope you're getting an early jump on the holiday weekend. Wall Street is certainly hoping for a jump as second quarter earnings season gets underway on Monday. The springtime rally convinced many investors that the economy is nearing or has hit bottom. Of course, yesterday's unemployment figures said otherwise. And no one believes next week's earnings will produce big fireworks. But at this point, even a backyard sparkler or two could boost hopes of a recovery. And here's another sign of optimism. There were five initial public offerings in the second quarter. It may not sound like much, but when you're coming out of a desert, even a little water is welcome. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Those five initial public offerings in May and June, they compare to just one IPO for the entire previous year. And on Wednesday, just as the third quarter kicked off, the IPO from software company LogMeIn came in 25% above its starting price. So, a sign of things to come? I asked Bob Ackerman of Allegis Capital in Silicon Valley.
Are we going to see a land rush of 40 IPOs in the second half? No, I wouldn't expect that.
Keep in mind, even 40 IPOs would have been considered mediocre before the recession hit. Still, Ackerman's what you could call cautiously optimistic. He thinks more companies that venture capitalists have nurtured through the bad times will launch now.
If the markets continue to be reasonably stable and if we don't have any body blows to the broader economy, I think that you will see continued momentum to build for public companies.
Now, we all remember the heady days of the dot-com boom. Venture capitalist Al Waxman of the Silos Group says, by contrast, today's IPOs will be no-frills affairs with a proven track record.
I don't think they have to be sexy. I think they have to be growth and earnings machines. I think they have to have business models that people who buy public stocks can understand.
Waxman specializes in healthcare investment. He says these days we're seeing more money flow to decidedly unsexy medical device and software companies and much less go to risky biotech firms that develop new drugs. It seems like right now investors aren't eager to gamble in this very down-to-earth economic environment. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Scenes from the coup in Honduras have been broadcast around the world, but increasingly the story out of the Central American nation is censorship. The military government has detained reporters, stormed TV stations, and taken broadcasts off the air. Still, one news outlet has distinguished itself, Telesur, a network financed by Venezuela's Hugo Chavez and his allies. From the Americas desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
Telesur was created 5 years ago as a leftist alternative to CNN and Espanol. Telesur started out underfunded and understaffed. But during the recent coup in Honduras, it has beat the competition with its up-to-date coverage. Marcelo Balbe is an editor at New American Media, a news service.
This is the place to go if I wanted, you know, gritty, on-the-street kind of footage from Honduras.
This anti-coup rally wasn't covered by many local media outlets, but it was on Telesur. Because of this kind of coverage, the military has blocked Telesur's signal inside Honduras. But its newscasts can still be seen across Latin America, and Telesur videos have become the buzz on social media sites like Twitter and YouTube.
Before Telesur, you had, you know, CNN in Spanish, BBC in Spanish, but you didn't have a homegrown regional cable news channel. It introduces just another voice into the discourse.
Telesur relies on oil-rich Venezuela for most of its funding. But with Venezuela facing tight times, Telesur last month had to close bureaus in the U.S., Mexico, and Brazil. John Dingus is a journalism professor at Columbia University. He says Telesur's exposure in Honduras isn't likely to solve the network's financial woes.
I don't know if it's going to make them any money, but it's certainly going to get them a bigger audience and a bigger slot on the cable networks that they appear on.
CNN en Español remains the dominant network in the region, but Telesur may be catching up. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
After yesterday's rout, U.S. investors took the day off to prepare the grill. We'll have details on the rest of the world financial markets when we do the numbers. On this Independence Weekend, we thought we'd take a look at some of the ways folks are declaring their financial freedom in this recession. Paul Kodrowski is a senior fellow at the Kauffman Foundation, and he argues that entrepreneurs are one ticket out of the economic mess. I asked him how starting a new business is really possible when we're in the middle of a credit crunch.
It's never easy to be an entrepreneur, and it's particularly hard whenever capital is scarce, but the reality is that the vast majority of those companies start with credit cards. They start with your own personal bank, which happens to be your credit cards. And so those things aren't really going away. Maybe the total amount of credit you have is a little less than you had before. But the disappearance or the relative absence of the more high-profile sources of credit really shouldn't affect anything.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what else might stand in the way of entrepreneurship these days. And you argue that there's a certain amount of prejudice about what makes an entrepreneur. Explain that for us.
Right. I mean, we have this made in Hollywood or maybe made in Silicon Valley view of entrepreneurs, which says that they're, you know, 22-year-old, recent Stanford graduates in a garage somewhere in Palo Alto.
Right.
which is a great story, and we all love to tell it. But the reality is, outside of tech, most entrepreneurs are over the age of 35. It's a pretty even cross-section between men and women. It's a much, much more broad, less youth-centric focus. It just so happens that in technology, it is younger folks in Silicon Valley, and that's, you know, the wrong place to focus, because coming out of this recession, it's going to require entrepreneurial activity in far more areas than internet software.
Well, so then you have these non-20-somethings who are opening up these businesses. What is standing in their way? You do talk about how healthcare is a really big issue.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, one of the myths in entrepreneurship is this idea that the primary obstacle is the availability of capital, when most entrepreneurs are ego-driven people who believe that they can manage technology risk, they can manage capital risk. What they can't manage is health risk.
So this is an argument for universal healthcare, that will then allow people who are more worried about their health and really need the insurance to go out and start their own businesses.
Right. And as you know, if you look at surveys of entrepreneurs who are outside of the sort of the 25 to 35 demographic, their concern is, what happens if I get sick? And that prevents those people, many of those people, from going out and being entrepreneurial. They're risk takers, but they don't want to take risks in areas that they can't manage them, and health is one they can't manage. So adequate health care is actually an incredibly important obstacle that we need to face down if we want more entrepreneurs outside the 20-something demographic.
Well, so aside from healthcare, what are some of the other policy changes you think might be needed to help pave the way for these folks who want to start something new?
So, you know, healthcare aside, another example of an area where, you know, I think we could do a lot is in education, and not the obvious thing of saying, let's create more entrepreneurship programs. A better example of what we could do using education as a lever is to recognize that something like a third of all tech startups on the West Coast, to use that group again for a second, had immigrant founders. And we should make life easier for more such people who come to this country to do master's and PhD level education, to go out then and start a new company. So my suggestion is, and I say this somewhat glibly, but I think it's a legitimate point, of attaching green cards to postgraduate diplomas in this country.
Literally attaching the green card to the diploma.
1, 2, 3, go. I mean, it certainly beats the alternative, is where we give them this wonderful education, send them home and say, you know, good luck starting some new companies that we'll then worry about later on. Why don't we try and take advantage of it and build upon that success rather than making it more difficult for ourselves?
To learn more about Paul Kodrowski's views on entrepreneurship, check out his article in the Washington Monthly called The Next Frontier. There's a link to it on our website, marketplace.org. The global economy is about more than big conglomerates and multinationals. When you boil it all down, it's about a single person doing a job, trying to get by. Today on our series, Working, the entrepreneurial spirit turns our electronic waste into someone else's treasure. The EPA says only 18% of the used electronics in this country are recycled. Well, one woman in northern Mexico looked across the border at our growing pile of junk and saw an opportunity for herself and her town. Ingrid Lobet has our profile.
Vicky Ponce stands in front of a mountain of shattered TV carcasses and pries a big piece of copper off the back of a picture tube.
Llegó el momento de la verdad.
The moment of truth.
Each day, Vicky bends over this workbench with a small group of women and dismantles TVs and computers collected across southern Arizona.
La compañera ya trajo esta televisión.
My friend is taking apart this TV. The first screws you take out are on the top.
Getting this job was a major struggle, but Vicky says it's not like life had been easy before. For 4 years, she and her husband had no steady work.
We were selling tamales on the streets. Sometimes we even crossed the border to clean houses.
There just aren't that many jobs here in Fronteras, 45 minutes south of the Arizona border. And what jobs there are, says Vicky's friend Lydia Barreda, don't go to women like them in their 50s and 60s.
Aquí en México sí hay mucha discriminación para una persona ya mayor.
Here in Mexico, there's a lot of discrimination against people who are older. After the age of 35, it's hard to get a job. It's not like in the United States, where older people keep on working.
So hard up and fed up, 3 years ago, Vicky and several other women here vowed to figure out how to bring more jobs to Fronteras. And they called on a friend with connections in the U.S., a local rancher named Alice Valenzuela. They asked her to help.
Everybody said the women's cooperative would never make it. We had no money and no contacts, so we would never find a building in which to put a business. We would never find an investor who would want to come to a town with dirt streets and no infrastructure.
But soon Alice Valenzuela made a contact, the owner of a Vermont recycling company called RetroWorks. The company was looking to expand and agreed to do it here in Fronteras. So the women traveled to Vermont and learned the e-waste business. Now Vicky can give the name and value of every part of a computer.
Estas contienen mucho oro.
We sort these parts into different barrels. They each contain different metals. These right here contain a lot of gold. We send these to Malaysia.
Thanks to contacts they got from RetroWorks Vermont, the Mexico startup now sells parts to Egypt, Malaysia, and Florida. They work out of this huge abandoned warehouse they convinced local officials to lend them. Yet 16 months after they moved in and started taking things apart, there's still no electricity. The mayor told the utility not to turn it on. He's been their biggest foe. Vicky and the others have their suspicions why.
Probably it's because we haven't made any contributions to him. Or it could be that he hates us because we stood up for ourselves.
Vicky and many others here in Fronteras believe their startup would have moved more quickly if they were willing to pay bribes, but they're not. Vicky says she may not have much, but she's got her reputation.
Queremos todo limpio.
We want everything clean. We want to hold our heads up. We don't want people to say we were involved in anything shady.
Paying bribes, she says, would also reinforce a negative view of her country.
Para que los inversionistas...
We want foreign investors to know that we're operating honestly.
Because Vicky has plans. RetroWorks Mexico is still tiny, only 10 employees, but she wants to bring many more jobs here.
Para hacerlo grande.
We want to make it grow big, so there's a job here for anyone who wants to work, so we can all live. Maybe not in luxury, but with dignity.
In the meantime, with no electricity, they press on with hand tools, screwdrivers, pliers, wrenches, and wire cutters.
Porque si fuera con pistola,
oof. If we had an air gun, our hands wouldn't be cramping up.
Vicky says this long fight to get RetroWorks started has made her less timid and less tolerant of the old way of doing business in Mexico, like on her fourth trip to a government office for a customs permit when they told her she'd have to come back a fifth time.
I said, we're not leaving here until you sign that paper. I said, do these look like pretty hands with painted fingernails? No, you see the hands of a working woman, and people in our town need that paper so we can keep working.
Local people call them las chicas bravas, the tough girls. One person who's seen them get tougher is Marco Antonio Armendariz, a legal advocate. On a visit to his office, Vicky and he reminisce about when the chicas first called him for help.
They were terrified. They didn't know their rights.
The mayor of Fronteras was threatening to evict them, saying the building wasn't really theirs.
They didn't know the mayor didn't have the authority to kick them out.
And then he turns to Vicky with a bombshell.
Someone called and offered me $20,000 to tell you that you had no case, that you had to vacate the building and stop pushing.
He speculates the chicas may have fouled up someone's plans to use the building for something illegal, like stashing drugs.
A lo mejor vaya a ser la primera empresa.
Maybe they'll be the first business to ever get started in Mexico without paying a single bribe.
When she's not at work, Vicky is most often at her wood stove, cooking. It's the hearth of the two-bedroom home she shares with her husband, Antonio.
Frijolitos salen más buenos con leñita.
Vicky and Antonio have two grown daughters in Arizona. The girls used to send money home, but now their daughters have both lost their jobs. So Antonio says the parents are helping out their kids in the United States.
The roles are reversed now. Instead of money coming from there to here, it's flowing from here to there.
The small recycling enterprise is so successful that Vicky says one daughter keeps asking when she can return to Fronteras and get a job there.
She says, Mommy, hurry up with the plant. I want to come home and work there.
Nothing, Vicky says, would please her more.
Ingrid Lobet went to Fronteras, Mexico to get that story for us. Our series, Working, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. We've got pictures of Vicky Ponce and the archive of the whole series at marketplace.org. Coming up, when do-it-yourself can do you in.
Maybe if I just take some off the back, it'll look good. And then it was just like, no, I've reached the point of no return.
Cutting your own hair and more. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed in observance of Independence Day, but yesterday's worse-than-expected unemployment numbers here in America rattled the confidence of foreign investors, a possible sign that the world is still farther from an economic recovery than many had hoped. In Europe, London's FTSE and the Paris CAC 40 each nudged up less than 0.25%, while Frankfurt's DAX dipped 0.25%. Tokyo's Nikkei dropped 0.6%, and Sydney was down about 1.25%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter. People are talking about business and the economy at Gather.com. And by the First 5 Years Fund, working to expand early learning for the nation's most at-risk children and provide benefits for society, FFYF.org. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. President Barack Obama visits Moscow for a summit on arms control. Former President Bill Clinton makes a trip to Haiti. It's his first visit as a UN special envoy to the Caribbean country. And the Dalai Lama has a birthday. He turns 74. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
The This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Frugal chic appears to have taken hold of this nation. Don't get caught exiting the mall with a new pair of pants. Make your own lunch or prepare to be mocked. But some are taking their newfound love of financial independence to the extreme, including commentator W. Hodding Carter, who is chronicling his family's year-long experiment in rural Maine at gourmet.com.
For years, my wife Lisa told me we were overspending. Even kicked me out of the house once for 6 months to wake me up. She said we didn't need to eat out, all six of us, twice a week, every week. That it wasn't smart to borrow against our house to make a $200,000 renovation since we only had a few thousand in savings. That I really didn't need those hand-carved walnut countertops our contractor had suggested I might like. That since we'd made a conscious decision to spend more time with our kids and less on our careers, we also had to consume less. Did I listen? No, because I knew that my next book was going to be a bestseller. It happened to my fellow Mainer Stephen King. Of course it would happen to me. Well, it hasn't. And last fall, one of those discussions devolved into tears. The next day, my annual Social Security statement arrived. To calm Lisa down and prove her wrong, I actually looked at it for the first time in years. Panicking, I then looked at hers. Turns out we'd only averaged a combined income of $41,000 a year for the last 10 years. That's about 150% of the federal poverty level for a family of six. The killer, though, is that we've been living for the most part as if we've been making $100,000 a year. We pulled this off by repeatedly refinancing and shuffling between low-interest home equity loans and zero-interest credit card transfers. An inheritance, a fortuitous house sale, and some lump-sum book advances kept us going. But by last fall, it was all gone. Except for the debt. We had to get frugal, big time. So we, quote, decided to live on what's left every month after paying our mortgage, taxes, and various insurances. That's $550 a month. Since January, we've been trying to buy groceries, drive our two cars, pay for utilities, and keep our four kids happy on an amount that we used to blow in a single trip to the supermarket. How's it going? We're getting there, thanks to tapping maple trees, shopping at liquidation grocery stores, never eating out, and giving up paper towels, and no cost-cutting measures off-limits. I came across a young mallard a few weeks ago, obvious roadkill, and brought it home for dinner. No one flinched, except maybe just a bit when I hung it in the basement for a few days to tenderize and improve the flavor. We began living this way because we had to, but now we're living the frugal life because it's what we believe in. We work together in our three new vegetable plots and have more fun than we ever did spending money. We're no longer afraid of the other shoe falling because we're finally putting one foot in front of the other. We are the Carters, broke, happy, and for once, living within our means.
W. Hodding Carter is writing about his family's experience with frugality on the website of Gourmet Magazine. We've got a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And while you're there, tell us what extremes you're going to save money. There are certainly other ways to declare your financial independence without resorting to eating roadkill. Lots of us have decided that maybe we should just try to fix the leaky shower ourselves. But that do-it-yourself project you took on to save money, it could cost more than you think. Sally Herships has that story.
If you were a pioneer heading west in a wagon train a couple centuries ago, then you needed to be handy to be able to fix things yourself. At least that's what Bill Horn says.
If it's 1830 and you're in the middle of Kansas and the wagon wheel comes off, well, you better know how to fix a wagon wheel.
Horn installs computers and fixes networks. But lately, to save money, his customers have been going DIY, do it yourself.
But it's not 1830 anymore.
Circuit boards can be trickier than wagon wheels. And instead of fixing things, his customers tend to make them worse. Like the time a client pulled some old machines out of the stockroom and plugged them into the office network.
They didn't call me. They just plugged them in, and they'd been back there for 3 or 4 years. They didn't know they had viruses in them.
It took 2 full days for Horn to debug the network. And he says it cost a lot more than it would have if they just called him in the first place.
It was probably about 6 times as much.
Ouch.
Yeah, I know.
So many of his clients are trying to cut back, Horn says. His only business right now is cleaning up their messes. But he's lucky. He's in a line of work where most jobs can be cleaned up. Then there's butcher Marty Prokop.
And you take your knife and you want to hold it at approximately a 30-degree angle or so.
Prokop is a deer processor. That means he turns bucks, the kind with antlers, into burgers. And butchering big game can get pretty messy.
Once it gets to the point where it starts to smell funny, there's no amount of money that can fix that.
Like the deer carcass a hunter decided to clean before cutting up.
Well, he soaked it in his bathtub.
What?
In his bathtub. Yes. Soaked it in his bathtub.
It seems like people will try anything to cut back. ProCop says hunting can be expensive. Bagging your deer could run up to $500.
You've got the bullet costs. Let's say your shells are going to cost you a dollar or two apiece. You've got the hotel stay, the drive up.
And if you skimp on one thing, deer processing, do it yourself and do it wrong, you could be throwing all your money away. But the number of SOS calls ProCop's been getting is up by 20%. And he charges more when he has to salvage meat from a hacked up deer. So why do people risk the added expense?
I alter my own clothes, like I make my own skirts. I made the pillowcase covers over there and the little pillows.
Anna Boyko-Wyrock is a radio producer and a friend. She says she's a pretty crafty person. To economize, she decided to cut her own, already short, hair with, I'd like to add, a pair of orange plastic-handled kitty scissors.
I basically just sat here and, just like grabbed a little chunk in the back and was just like chop, chop, chop.
Well, you know where this is going.
Maybe if I just take some off the back, it'll look good. And then it was just like, no, I've reached the point of no return.
Not one bald spot, but two. Back to Bill Horn.
I wish people would just stop and think ahead and ask themselves how much it's really going to cost when they try to save a penny.
Both Horn and Marty ProCop stand to get more business from customer screw-ups, but both say they'd rather see it done right the first time. And as for Boyko-Wyrock, in the end, she decided to head to the barbershop and pay a professional. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace. Would you ever cut your hair again?
No, unless I was going to give myself a buzz cut, and that way I would be sure that I would not mess it up.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, at least one of the nation's 15 million unemployed has a potential job opportunity. Former NFL quarterback Michael Vick could play for the new United Football League when it debuts in October. The commissioner of the UFL says the league may be willing to let Vick join up, barring any legal issues. He recently served 18 months in federal lockup for his involvement in a dogfighting ring. Meanwhile, Vick's lawyers submitted their latest proposal to a bankruptcy judge yesterday. He would get to keep his car and house in the Hamptons, but creditors would get a bigger chunk of any future earnings. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. The U.S. markets were closed today. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, novel ways to see new sights this summer.
Be an ambulance chaser this summer for travel. Go where the disasters are.
Iceland on a dime, anyone? I'm Tess Viglund. Have a great 4th.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.